Hello there, and welcome to the Thinky Fellows podcast, part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of our shows there. And 1517 is more than a podcast network. If you just go to 1517.org, you can see daily blogs, weekly preaching helps, regular video content, two conferences a year, and some other various speakers at local churches maybe near you. Again, that's 1517.org, and you should be able to see some of that and navigate to that content pretty easily. Today, I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Adam Francisco. We've been doing episodes themed around why you should for quite some time, over half a year now, I think. I think we started in January. Hard to keep track of all of that. So thank you for those of you who have been sticking around with us as we tell you what you should do. We promise this has not turned into a total advice show if you're new to the Thinking Fellows.
Could you imagine us doing life coaching?
Oh, man.
I'd just start listening to old episodes of Dr. Laura and just like parrot.
Oh, no.
Well, I kind of feel like we'd just always default on like, do what you want. Do what you think you need to do.
Well,
just play that on like a broken record.
On repeat, yeah. Today, I think we're going to do a fun one. I think it'll be fun, at least.
Well, it'll be fun for me.
It'll be fun for you. That's why we did it. We don't want you to get burned out from recording and your busy schedule and all of that. So we'll do one up your alley. This one like came to me a couple weeks ago. I was like, oh, this will be fun. And we're going to do why you should care about the world wars. And I think the reason it came to me is because there's, you know, internet memes. There's one that's like every boy when he turns 4 chooses one of these things and makes it his whole personality. And it's trains is one, planes is another, construction is another, and dinosaurs is the last one, right? And then there's a pairing that's like every dad when he turns 40 makes one of these things his whole personality. And it's like world wars, grilling, perfect yard, you know, and like, so you have to pick one. And I know at least for you, when you, yours was World Wars.
Yeah, I've done some deep dives.
Adam, I didn't know that about you. I'm kind of all of the above. I love a well manicured lawn.
Me too.
I like the World Wars.
I'm not big on barbecue.
I have a Traeger which I can control from my phone. Ooh, so I can literally be at the jiu-jitsu gym.
I didn't even know you knew how to check the email on your phone.
He just missed a meeting.
He's sitting here. He's got the Traeger app all figured out. But it's like his email. He's like, how do you hit send?
I actually don't. I just know how to adjust the temperature. There's like a gajillion things you can do on it, but I don't know how to do it. I'm not going to learn. And I just downloaded this morning an app for my trail camera, which I'm going to set up for this afternoon in Michigan. Yeah. So I'm getting pretty high tech. I'll be able to see what sort of bucks are eating my corn.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. So there's a lot of with the why you should, you know, we've had like care, read, know about. You know, I think most people know generically about the world wars. It's certainly a subject in like high school, middle school history classes generically. If you accidentally click onto the History Channel, I'm sure if you're on it long enough, it'll be there.
Not anymore. You're going to have to get through all of like the fishing and picking.
Oh, aliens.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but there was a period in time where literally
it was almost all it was.
Every other show on the History Channel was a World Wars show.
You know, in professional historical associations like the American Historical Association, we call the History Channel we used to call it the Nazi Channel.
Yeah,
because that's all they
that's
did.
All it was, was documentaries on Hitler.
That's probably one of the things that first got me interested in it, honestly.
I mean, it was being fed there, for sure. And then, so there's definitely a lot of interest, and I get that there's a big differences between World War I and World War II, so I'm lumping them together here, but for the sake of this episode, I think we're going to do that for the Thinking Fellows.
I love the ilk that they're imminently lumpable. I don't know if Adam is or not, but I am.
Meaning it's one big war with a let's
with
say
a pause, 20 year with a hip pause.
Yeah, I'm of the ilk as well that they're lumpable, as you put it.
Yeah. Well, great. Then we have accidentally landed on a lump here, and so I think why you should care though helps hit the fact that everybody maybe knows a little bit about the world wars, but is there a particular reason today that people should care outside of sort of the platitude that those who don't know the past are doomed to repeat it? And maybe if that is the best reason, make a case for it as well. And then maybe toss a Thinking Fellows spin and talk about, is there any reason, like if you're interested in the study of theology, that in the...
Well, that's my main interest in it.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Other than like, I'm very interested in the history and the political ramifications, but there are deeper epistemological and theological ramifications.
Well, let's have at it then. Oh. So, world wars. Can you? You're not jumping again. That's fine. Let's just set the borders, the dates, the countries, and the major powers involved.
Yeah,
with World War I and then move into the gap.
Talking about the entire dateline, and can I give a few caveats here? I'm not a historian. I am a person...
Like I'm not a theologian. But.
I'm a person who's interested in history. I have a deep interest in history, but that's sort of natural with the brand of theology that I was taught to be my craft, which is typically historical theology. A little bleeding in of systematics, which is very common now. Like if you do,
I like to call it historical systematics.
Yeah. If you do sort of systematics, you're typically, unlike Steve Paulson, not writing sort of a new thing. You're kind of studying the history of systematics.
Even that though is a little sneaky because he's doing a lot of Luther history.
Yeah. And so, but history is just of great interest to me, and I love to try to see if there the connections between the historical events and how they sort of affected how people think and react, and how they view, on the political end, how they view things like ideas like liberty and freedom, and the theological end, you could say the same thing, how they view their ideas of God and sin and what they're willing to bet on as far as religion goes, and how far they're willing to take their belief systems and that type of thing. And definitely, I think with the world wars, both of them, there's a change in the sort of epistemological framework that starts out in Europe and that makes its way here. So the reason I say that is because I'll give some dates, but when I studied this, I didn't primarily study on memorizing the exact dates of when X, Y, or Z happened.
That's fine.
So the broad time frame that you're talking about here is going to be 1914 to 1945. So 1914 to 18 is World War One. 1939, starting with the Germany's invasion of Poland, is generally, I think, considered the beginning of World War Two. To 1945. On the American side, for most of our listeners, they're probably American. Believe it or not, America doesn't enter World War One until 3 years in, until 1917, and doesn't fully enter World War Two until 1941. Most of that is sort of initial entry happens not in Europe, but in North Africa. In the what they call the European theater, and then in the Pacific theater after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, what's left of sort of the American naval fleet goes on the hunt. So after that, and you get things like very classic Battle of Midway and that type of thing. That sounds roughly accurate, Adam.
Yeah, it's sort of like when every once in a while you send me these texts with references to American presidents, and what they did. I'm like, how the heck does he know this?
Well, I mean, speaking of American presidents, the American president during World War One is Woodrow Wilson. The American president during World War Two is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The interesting connection there is that FDR was in the Wilson cabinet during World War One. And so his sort of view, if you kind of think of what we got out of FDR, not just during wartime, but with the New Deal to get us out of sort of the what he said would get us out of the quote unquote Great Depression. There's some very kind of rehashing of Wilsonian progressive ideas that, you know, Wilson was able to take so far under emergency war powers, and then FDR was able to take further under sort of the fact that he had the entire Congress behind him too.
Didn't he even issue a new Bill of Rights of some, I mean, yeah. not like a, official, but
which
a
one?
New Bill of Rights at. What's that?
Which one? Wilson or Roosevelt?
Roosevelt.
Yes. So Wilson does too, in a sense, at the end of World War One, as he's trying to get together the League of Nations.
Right.
Then, FDR was proposing, it was shut down by this point because it was very late in his four terms, I think he was proposing a constitutional amendment that would called an economic bill of rights, and it would have guaranteed things like so it's very much what we hear proposed now.
Living wage.
Yeah, living wage. I think Adam's frozen.
He is. Internet in Chicago, huh? Oh, there you are.
That's weird.
Yeah. All right. So back to the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
Where did you hear me stop, Adam?
You mentioned Wilson and the League of Nations, and that's when you trailed
okay.
off.
And then FDR, late in his terms, which you know he has four of them. He dies in his fourth term, so that's not completely accurate that he serves out all four terms.
But he's elected into four.
Yes. He proposes something called an economic bill of rights, which would be like guaranteed wage, guaranteed health coverage. It's in a lot of ways a lot of what you see after World War II happen in the UK with the sort of forming of the national healthcare system and all that. He's proposing that in America. Towards
the rise of the welfare state, really.
Yeah. What you do get out of that, a couple things you do get out of that, you do get Social Security comes out of that. That comes earlier. But what you do get out of that is the, the GI Bill. So, which if you take the sort of the full name of the GI Bill is the GI Bill of Rights, which guaranteed returning veterans from World War II, education expenses that would be paid, as well as help buying a house, essentially. So, and I think those persist to this day. If you serve in the military, you'd get some educational reimbursement and you get some different loan terms on buying a house.
Adam, yeah,
the VA loan, I've used two of them.
Yeah.
And it is a tremendous benefit. Basically, you can buy a house with zero money down.
Yeah, and not pay PMI and the whole nine yards, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And the GI Bill now the GI Bill is outstanding. Back when I was getting it, it was basically enough to cover my beer expenses each month for 36 months. But now it's full ride and then some. So and well deserved for those coming out of the war on terror and so.
Yeah, I know. I knew some people who went to Concordia. During my time using it, and it seemed like it was a pretty nice package for them.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, so that's
you mentioned Scott. Okay, you mentioned the
I love this stuff so much.
Yeah, the well, if maybe this is too quick, but or too soon, but the change in epistemology.
Yeah. I mean, so
we've talked before on this show about the change in the mood of people, especially in Europe after World War One. You know, before it's everybody's, I mean, the horizon is wide open. All sort, you know, optimism is everywhere. And then after World War One, like actually right in the middle of World War One, you can see it in World War One literature, poetry in particular, where it starts off very patriotic and this is your patriotic duty to go off and fight. And then the last 2 years, the same authors or the same poets are talking about this sense of it being your patriotic duty as an old lie. And
yeah, even the songs change and everything.
I saw it was a picture. I don't know if it was after World War One or Two, but it was like of a parade in England afterwards. And there were mothers in a like a carriage being towed around, and they had a sign on it that was like, "These mothers gave 12 sons to their nation."
Oh, the thing that happens. I mean, not only do literally millions of people die in World War, and mostly Europeans, right, die in World War One, and Russians. I mean, tons. I mean, millions. Mm. Russia, I mean, boy, I can go. There's so many places you could go with this. Russia actually pulls out of the war earlier, mostly because they're having this like brutal revolution going on, and it's now lack of support for sending people to die in Russia during the revolution and into Germany and France. But not only do so many people die, I mean, they lose a generation of men. For like even reproductive purposes, right? Like the young women that are left behind, like in the UK, are having to find older and younger men than them to even marry and have children. But there's just an enormous rate of like amputation too. Mm. And so the parades before the war are these strong, able men lining up to march out to go to battle, and the parades are after the war. For the men that are marching that are left are amputees, you know.
Yet, add to that shell shock.
I was just going to say, and shell shock. And
there's a documentary just called Shell Shock on how you could walk down the streets of London and you'll see a guy who might have half his head missing, and he's walking in squares as he's moving forward. Just all sorts of, and it's tragic. It's hard to get through. And it certainly makes sense why the mood in Europe is so depressed after
you get a sense of quote unquote modern warfare on large scale for the same time. You have massive artillery, which is the artillery is not new, but the range of the artillery and the fact that you can't move far enough away to hide from the artillery to get out of range of the artillery is somewhat new. You not only have gunfire like you have, but you now have the integration of the automatic machine gun and machine gun emplacements that can literally, as troops are trying to advance, can just take out literally thousands of people as they're coming. Trench warfare, I mean, they dig all of these trenches in order to try to find some cover from both the artillery and the machine gun emplacements, and it's just... I don't think we can imagine. I actually don't think we can imagine the horror of all of that. Maybe if you're a veteran to some degree and you served, like in one of the wars against terrorism, maybe. But there's an intensity to this that, as far as everything I've seen and read, just seems unmatched, even to some degree in World War II.
Like powers that are in many ways equally technologically powerful, whereas a lot of the wars that we know in the United States and the West today, there's a technological and superiority where it doesn't mean there's casualty lists, but just not the same, you know, per capita death rates as when both sides have the same power.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think more than like... World War One is interesting because, and Adam can totally correct me if I'm wrong on this, but there's lots of debate on the reason for the starting of World War One, and there's so much debate on it that a lot of people land on the idea that there's just not a good reason for the starting of World War One. There's just not something that you can point to and say, like, for instance, the United States enters World War Two after Japan bombs Pearl Harbor naval base.
That's pretty black and white.
In Hawaii, the next day, Germany declares war against the United States because it's an ally of the Japanese Empire. Pretty clear why we then finally entered World War II after several years of saying we weren't going to, right? That's a pretty clear line of demarcation. You could say the same thing in World War II with Germany invading Poland. Right. That starts the war. They make their way down too. So they kind of on the Blitzkrieg, they make their way down through to Europe, various parts of Europe. But then they start bombing raids against the United Kingdom in 1940 called the Blitz. Right. And so it's pretty clear why the United Kingdom declares war on Germany, because they have war guarantees with countries like Poland that they would ally if they're ever attacked, and then they are attacked themselves by Germany. That's all very clear. It's less clear in World War One. They usually pin it to the assassination of
Franz Ferdinand.
Franz Ferdinand.
Franz Ferdinand. Archduke. It was Gavril Princip who was his assassinator.
Yeah. But that's an interesting thing. I mean, he's related to German nobility. But he's related to, they're all related. In a weird way, he's related to Nicholas the Russian Tsar too. And it's just so with that's not like a great answer, honestly.
Do you think that those European nations were still transitioning or actively imperialistic, fighting over different territories in other parts of the world often? Do you think it was just waiting for a reason to cross a border, and that something like a domino, like a Ferdinand?
It seems like the main tension, say, between the UK and Germany has to do with naval superiority. For a long time, the UK was the supreme naval power in the world. And during this time, Germany begins to build up its naval fleet, and this is causing a lot of tension. In fact, I think, Adam, I think the UK starts a blockade at one point to try to hold back the German Navy from certain areas that they can patrol. And this causes a lot of tension. And it seems to me basically what you get is a bunch of nations who are all have various imperial sort of machinations, UK foremost among them. But Germany is itself becoming a more imperialistic empire during this time and getting pushback from England and France because of that. And it's just a bunch of nations that wanted to grow, have more power. And
the land is being occupied already.
Well, and at some point, the talking stops. The sort of trying to work things out diplomatically breaks apart, which you see all the way through the war. Like, you see this through the Treaty of Versailles. Germany doesn't even send its, like, top officials to negotiate this treaty. has just stopped.
You might remember from whenever you did this in grade school, whether it was seventh grade or high school, there's an acronym that's always put on the board to describe the cause behind World War One: MAIN, militarism, alliances, imperialism, and nationalism. The Balkan region, that southeastern part of Europe, that had for a long time been under the Ottoman Empire. And it's starting to, the Ottoman Empire is starting to pull back its borders. And so you've got all these people from different regions that share a language and a heritage, sometimes kind of a made-up heritage, who are all claiming the right to self-determination, claiming the right that they constitute a nation, even though they might not be a nation. And then those groups are allying themselves with stronger powers, whether it's England or France or Germany or Austro-Hungarian Empire. And then those central powers, well, all the powers, Austro-Hungarian Empire, Germany, England, and France, they're building up their military, not necessarily because they're looking for a fight, but kind of just to show off. Mm-hmm. And they're also, even though colonialism and imperialism is well into that period of Europe's history, there's still a race going on for influence and power across the globe, especially in Africa. And so I think you're dead on that the cause for World War One, it's really odd, but at the same time, there's this perfect storm brewing that people aren't really aware of that's brewing.
They sort of refuse to see because they think they've evolved out of
that's the thing, right?
Sort of desire for mass warfare and death. They think they've evolved out of this. And this is, so you, if you take a lot of the scientific influences of the day and sort of the political progressive influences of the day, you hear language much like you'll hear today, like this never again type language, mm-hmm. right? We'll never again allow something like that. And you hear it, funny things, you hear it after World War I again.
Now we've just really learned our lesson.
Just in the, you know, less than 20 years that it takes for, or 22 years that it takes for World War II to be a thing. You know, there's just this sense that mankind has sort of overcome their sinful nature. We don't really have the church telling us to be, you know, we're not listening to the church, at least, really telling us to be ashamed of everything anymore. And we, through technology, we've overcome so many things and we've conquered so many things. Look at what we can build now that we could never build, but we could have never built before.
Lifespans are a lot longer by this period.
They're beginning to be, for sure. So, you know, you're starting to develop things like vaccines and medicines that are effective against infection and you know, all of this is just like coming to the fore. And in a lot of ways, you have to give them that this is an age of technological advancement, like it'll be difficult to see again. From horse to automobile, from automobile to airplane, in a relatively short period of time, from airplane to jet airplane, relatively short period of time from jet airplane to rockets that go into orbit. I mean, you're taking this all the way through World War II now, but you can kind of understand why they felt that way, sort of societally as a whole, why that was the driving societal ethos.
Well, if the next 100 years progressed as quickly, you would have, like, all the stuff, you know, you imagine from the TV of
you'd have the Jetsons.
You'd be living in...
And everybody thought it was going to continue to progress that quickly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So...
And then the interesting thing in World War I is the how technology is very quickly put to the service of war, mm-hmm. Such that this was expressed this way, but the principle was, how do we create weapons that can kill the maximum amount of people in the quickest amount of time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Machine guns, German U-boats, although there were kind of like these submarines used in the Civil War, there were nothing compared to those.
Well, even by World War I, the German U-boat is an amazing machine.
Sinking things like the Lusitania.
You have I think you can't overlook the what trains bring to warfare as far as like being able to bring supplies to advancing troops. In the past, you know, your troops could only advance. In fact, there was a war season that had to do with when the crops were coming up in the place that you wanted to conquer, because you could go steal the crops and you wouldn't have to have this big train of supplies following you.
And food, yeah.
Well, now this war season is less of a thing because you can bring stored up foods to the front lines via train lines. Yeah. So it's all just very interesting, like, that changes. We have sort of lots of informational technological changes now that move very quickly that make it hard for me to use my phone between software updates. But that's not the same as like, I only saw a horse and then I saw a car and then there was this thing flying in the air that had a dude in it.
Yeah. I mean, that it's interesting because the technology today is weaponized in a different way. It can't kill, you know, the most number of people in the quickest way possible, but it can assault people's minds or form people's decisions and opinions, the most amount of people in the quickest way possible.
Yeah.
Often. So it's, you know, that it's information warfare. That's why the hot button one of the hot button political issues is, you know, fake news, which what is real? How can you know that anything's real when you're getting information so quickly?
I wonder, you know, Scott, you said two things that really interest you about the world wars is the effects and the effect it has on epistemology as well as the West understanding of human beings. I wonder if this just sort of popped in my head, but there's a historian named Paul Johnson. He wrote The History of the American People, you know, to kind of counteract that awful book by Howard Zinn that is the source for the 1619 Project.
Yes.
But he has another book called, I think it's Modern Times, but he starts off in ancient Greece, I think. And
well, yeah, that's kind of funny.
He says something to the effect of all that was required to know to put a man on the moon or to create nuclear weapons was known in the ancient world. They had all the intellectual capacity.
I totally agree with that.
And yet they don't do it, nor do they do it in the Middle Ages and so on. And it makes me wonder...
It's hard to know what Rome would have done.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it'd be scary to think what they would have done, too. But I wonder if this notion that human beings are, at the very least, fallible and corrupted, maybe not a full doctrine of original sin, but, you know, that human beings are... We got to be cautious with everything we do because of what we're prone to do.
I think that's the key, honestly.
Is that what holds, if you will, technology back over the centuries? What's that?
It's what ought to.
Yeah, because it's interesting how once the doctrine of original sin or some version thereof, whether it's like a deistic conception of or whatever, once that's abandoned, that's when you see technological progress that is very, very beneficial in many ways, but also in the wrong hands.
Just explodes.
Yeah.
Or it's also, or even two sides of the same coin, right? Like, you know, you talk about the jump from plane, which not only is militarily useful, but, you know, who we all use them, or a lot of us use them now for very, very convenient, good travel. It's a way that you can live in California and see family members in Chicago with ease, right? You know, and then you get to this rocket. Well, that's a flip side of the coin. How did they develop, you know, manned rockets? Very, very evil experimentation on on people.
Werner von Braun is a flawed character.
Right. certain you know, like pharmaceutical advancements that prolong people's life also make it so that you could terminate life early or kill a baby in the womb easier or whatever, right? Like every one of the positive advancements has a dark side of the coin.
Well, that's the problem, is that we're still living. The funny thing is we've come through World War One. I think it's Adam, 6 million people die in World War One.
Yeah, I mean, the number, there's debate over the number, and it depends on how you break it up. So, is it just 6 to 10 belligerents, or
5 to 10? It's a lot. World War II, 30-some-odd million, and still the full number not known, because what you have to understand about World War II is it's literally a world war, in that not only are tons of world powers participating in the war, but it's fought all over the world. So in that sense, it's a world war, and to this day, they've had a hard time giving, you know, completely accurate count of the deaths for that reason. But you come through all of that, you come through, which I think is one of the most significant things that leads us into postmodernism, is not all that death in World War One and Two, but the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, where the realization, you know, meaningless, everything's meaningless. Comes to mind for everybody when all of a sudden there's a bomb, one bomb that can be dropped that can kill hundreds of thousands and can be dropped from an airplane that can make it to anywhere in the world at any time.
Yeah.
You know, then you put ICBMs on top of that, intercontinental ballistic missiles. And now you grow up in the 70s and 80s and you realize that one dude can push a button and can end humanity.
But it doesn't matter how well you live your life, how much medicine you have, your life can still end in a second.
But even given all of that, we still now have discussions today where we will, political discussions today, where we will allude to the fact that we are too advanced for any such thing to ever happen again. And it's stupid. I mean, you look at the never again, like even with concentration camps and sort of genocide, you hear this all the time, never again. Well, you got the Uyghurs in China, and this is going down right now, and nobody's throwing a fit about it.
Or think of slavery or involutary servitude.
Yeah,
They say there are more slaves today than there have ever been before.
Yes.
And everybody's up at arms about something that happened 200 years ago. And, we should, that's not just regrettable, but appalling. But nobody wants to lift a finger to do something about what's going on today. It's very strange.
So you come through all of this and you would think that what would be foremost on everybody's mind is original sin. But instead, what comes out of it, epistemologically and even epistemologically, one of the things that comes out of it is postmodernism, which can have sort of a nihilistic sort of hopelessness bent to it, but not really, because if you think about it in terms of sort of like constant deconstruction, the idea of deconstructing something is because you're smart enough to see that it's not yet perfect and that you're trying to deconstruct all the imperfection for the sake of allowing the cream to rise to the top, so to speak. But what comes out of it theologically is essentially Protestant liberalism, and then which is sort of that we know better now than the Bronze Age illiterate peasants, right? Of what is possible and not possible in the natural world, and so we can take out all the ideas of miracles and all the ideas of God interacting with His creation in a meaningful, positive way. Then. Sort of out of World War II, you get this new Orthodox movement, which is trying to counteract Protestant liberalism a little bit, but still can't get itself to quite say that maybe these things can happen in real time, in real history, and that God can act meaningfully for His people by sending His Son, who is actually God Himself, to actually die and to really rise again from the dead. So they have to use word play to create, you know, you could almost say, like, if you're going to say it in modern fantasy terms, other realms in which these realities happen so that they can be talked about in this realm where we know they can't happen. And it's just, there's a weird, initially hopelessness, which is kind of how you get the beat movement in literature. You start getting postmodern architecture and all that type of stuff that shows a little bit of this hopelessness. But by the time, by the, you know, the 60s, you know, what are all the anti-war protests all about? They're about, well, we're too evolved to go to war anymore. And so peace, not love. But then.
Love, not hate.
Peace, not war. Which then, though, in this sort of weird sort of love cult, drives them down into sort of like a sexual immorality that is too hopeless. You know, while still talking positively about the ability of the innate human nature to overcome. I just think it's so interesting. Sorry. And I think there's a direct connection to the death and destruction of World War I and World War II, which culminates in what you might call the optimal ability to create death and destruction with nuclear war. Mm-hmm. I did that last part really fast. That could have probably been a whole episode, but just saying.
Yeah. There's a lot there.
Calculating.
Why no, you when you referred to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you referred to it in that order. Usually it's the other way. Is there a reason for that?
No.
Oh, okay.
I do it the other way.
I thought you had some brilliant insight, and that's why you did it.
No, not really. Not really. The decision to do that is an interesting thing. It's an interesting moral dilemma. Yeah, I don't have time for that, but
I've been to.
I don't mean interesting as to minimize the hundreds of thousands of people that died. I mean, speaking sort of academically, the recorded discussions that you get are actually interesting because of how vehemently people are on either side of that, and that the Truman makes the decision to do it.
Have you been to Japan by chance and seen the? Either one
I have
of
not.
Those.
I have not.
I don't remember which one it was, but I was in Sasebo in the Navy and went over to either Hiroshima or Nagasaki, and you know they got a whole thing dedicated to it, and it's one of those things that'll make you stop and you know, think, and if not weep. It's like I saw the grave site of the National Cemetery at Verdun in France a couple of years ago. It was hard to keep things together there. Just the miles and miles of tombs.
Oh, even just going across, like visiting the Maginot Line and Normandy and things like that, you just can't even imagine.
It's one of those ones where, there's the whole world was touched, even places where there wasn't war. Like here, we drove to the Sierras and there's a Manzanar where they imprisoned Japanese Americans, right?
Japanese internment camp.
And that's like, that's a part of that war is that American citizens were interned.
And most of those people, most of the men that were let out of that would have gone to serve in the United States military.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And so you have the fingerprints of this thing sort of everywhere. If we have maybe a couple minutes left here.
I could do my like broad why you should though.
Yeah, really? You could do your broad why you should. I mean, obviously it touches every facet of modern life, and
that's the big why you should.
Yeah.
I mean, the effects of these wars, and I mean, if we at any point wanted to do another episode like this, you could draw the connection more closely why I think you basically have a war that hits pause and another war that goes on. A lot of that has to do with the Treaty of Versailles and the poor state in which it left in Germany, and the sort of the German mindset that came out of that poor state in which they were left. But why should you study these things? Just as an American, the political movements that were made during World War I and World War II by Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt fundamentally changed the way we see our constitutional structure of government in the United States. The way the Constitution interacted with the life of the people prior to World War I is different than it does now. And I'm not saying better or worse. I'm just saying different.
Can we say worse though?
Yeah. Can we say worse?
You could say in a lot. I think you, especially from an academic perspective, I think you could say less liberty. How that interacts with people's lives. I mean, I think some people would have a hard time making a case that Social Security is worse than not Social Security. You know, I'm not saying that I couldn't feel that way or make that argument academically, but in the meaningful lives of most people who, you know, at some point get to 65 and start collecting that to pay their rent, it'd be a difficult argument to make there. But it fundamentally changed everything. These things fundamentally changed everything. Learn a little bit, if you were upset about the power of the government during the lockdowns, during COVID-19 pandemic, learn about some of what the United States did to its citizens during World War I and World War II, simply for speaking out against the president. We're talking about incarceration for years, in some cases, thousands of people. This is why you say sort of the liberty aspects of your relationship with your constitutional rights change during these times. And it all has to do with like what governments can do during wartime.
Or emergency at all.
Yeah, emergency powers acts and things like that. But other than that, the mindset of individuals all across the world changed after these wars. If you kind of think of sort of, this is not quite accurate. So those of you who out there who are listening who know this is not quite accurate, I'm using this as just like a descriptive. You know, in the year, and Adam alluded, in the years prior to World War I, you were basically dealing with sort of the reign of Christendom over large parts of the West, right? As that sort of foothold on people's hearts and minds wanes, as sort of modern progressivism comes into play prior to World War I, this is how you get the, like he said, the unleashing of technological advancements, not just for good, but for ill too, without there being an easy way to stop it or an easy way to say that that's immoral, we shouldn't do that, that type of thing. Then you get these wars, millions and millions of people die. You get the development of the nuclear bomb, which, you know, Oppenheimer, who worked on the nuclear bomb in the United States, regretted for the rest of his life, because he thought it was an immoral project. You know, is man's technological ability gone too far? And then leading that into sort of like that modernism, which still sort of holds truth. You know, you have to kind of hold ideas of capital T truth to, convince millions of people to enlist, to go fight and die for a cause that you say they ought to believe in. This is what C.S. Lewis does in the beginning of Mere Christianity, right? To the loss of that, because no one's going to be willing. Fewer and fewer people are now willing to go fight and die for something that somebody else tells them is a capital T truth. And then postmodernism, and then up to whatever we're in now, which I'm not even convinced is postmodernism anymore.
I think it's something else.
It's some weird something else that somebody needs to do some research and write a book about.
Oh, they have. They call it applied postmodernism now.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Oh, I forget the name. He wrote Cynical Theories, James Lindsay. It's applied postmodernism is a fusion of a cultural Marxism and postmodernism that uses postmodernism.
You can certainly see the cultural Marxism.
Yeah. Anyway, that's off topic though.
Well, that's why you should study the World Wars.
Very cool.
Maybe you don't have to dive as deep as I did.
Yeah, it's funny. I put in the comments, I don't know if you guys saw it, I wrote, no historian, my rear end. I didn't write.
I never have the chat up on Zoom. There we go.
I had no idea Oppenheimer regretted it to his dying day.
He argued with Truman about the use of it and was basically kicked out of the Oval Office on the day he argued against it.
Yeah. Wow.
Crazy. Well, thank you for a fun episode.
I had a blast. You're right, Caleb. That was a fun one for me.
Yeah. Every once in a while, you got to do something to make your co-hosts happy. So I think that was a good choice. Well, thank you guys for listening to this episode of The Thinking Fellows. If you would like to support the show, there's two easy ways to do that. The first is to go to 1517.org/donate. You probably noticed while you were listening to this episode that there were no ads in this episode. That's a very rare thing in the podcasting world, and we would like to keep it that way on the 1517 Podcast Network. And the way we do that is by being completely donor-funded. If you would like to help us out, help 1517 reach its annual financial goals and fund all of its projects, you can go to 1517.org/donate. And the other way you can support us is by subscribing to the show in your favorite podcasting app. Subscribing to The Thinking Fellows is free. You can do it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Podcast Addict, and basically any other apps that you can think of where podcasts are found. And again, doing that really does support the show because you get the episodes as soon as they come out. And the podcasting platforms like to reward our search results and listing when we have more subscribers. So we really do appreciate that. We will catch you next time. Bye.